feel like eavesdropping on a conversation between Lao Tzu and Emerson? I can't quite offer you this, but Stephen Buhner's latest book, Ensouling Language, on the Art of Nonfiction and the Writer's Life, explores what that meeting of Lao Tzu and Emerson could have sounded like. Regarding Stephen's masterful writing and connection to the natural world, one author stated, "The earth will love you for reading his work." I would say you will love you for reading his work. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Stephen, I believe your story lies in the back of your book, Ensouling Language, right before the appendices where you say, by the way, this book you just read, it's a how-to book. And I feel like by not saying it's a how-to write a book, you do encompass the essence of being the artist, being a more conscious creator of your own life, the macro and the micro, so to speak.
Yeah, the thing is about a lot of, well, even just writing books, is that they focus so much on the, like, nouns or verbs or adverbs, or you put these words in this kind of row and you're a writer. Nah, and what you really are doing when you do that, you become a typist, not a writer. And so for me, it was the how-to of art, which is what I put in the subtitle of the book, which is on the art of nonfiction. But what's really true when you look at it, the process of art is very much the same for every kind of artist. I'm a musician as well as a writer. I work a lot in wood as well as those two things. And the process is exactly the same for all of them. You're just using a different medium. And what I was trying to encourage in people with that whole concept of it being a serious how-to book was, how do you get to the heart of art? How do you really follow that thing in you that wants that expression out into the world? And when you think about what art is not a bunch of words in a row. It's when you read that story, like as John Gardner, the writer, once put it, he said, you read a few words at the beginning of the page, and suddenly you're not seeing words on a page, but an old Russian crying or a rain house or a farmhouse battered by rain. Somehow you go into this kind of other state. There's some deep meaning that comes out of the art form that changes your perception of reality. That's the crux of art. It's that intangible, invisible thing that artists have a sense of, and they try to capture in some sort of a stable medium. But when you encounter that medium, like you encounter another human being, it comes alive and you suddenly have this shift of perception or feeling or just the way your life is structured. So that's the real crucial part of the book for me in the whole dynamics is when I say this is a how-to book, it's like how to do that, because that is what art really is.
Yes, and however, you do have a title, chapter 22, I believe, about the grammar Nazis and editors from hell. So you did good. You covered it all.
Well, I covered it all, but what I wanted to do was in the beginning deal with the heart of what it is to create art when you have that intangible thing that touches you and you want to capture it in a medium in such a way to touch somebody else. That's the core of it. And once you
exactly
begin getting that on paper or in whatever form you're working, then you start to look at the technique dynamics. How can I refine the technique to enhance that thing? And yeah, when you're writing, you run into grammar Nazis and editors from hell. And so somebody's got to talk about it.
Right. And I'm sure when you're writing, after you've gotten that essence and you're looking at the refining of your story to move into completion with it, I'm sure the author oftentimes becomes the grammar Nazi.
Well, it's a different thing. I mean, I know what you're saying by that, but they don't, you know, some writers do that, and I personally do not think they're the best writers. What a writer does is, you know, I have a quote in there from Mark Twain, which is just great. He said, how to condense you know, an entire page or several pages of work into one paragraph, which has that luminous brilliance inside of it. And so when you're first writing, you're just putting everything down as it comes until you have this huge mass of material, and then you begin this winnowing process. But you're not doing it because grammar has to be used this way or that way. What you're doing is you're trying to cut all of the excess fat so that you end up with that luminous brilliance condensed to a single paragraph, so that the impact of the piece on the reader is as potent as it possibly can be. So you haven't diluted the art that you're creating. And so writers that are in service to the essence of the thing do it for a different reason. A grammar Nazi does it because they think that reality will fall apart if words aren't used properly, you know. But the writer doesn't care about that. They care about, how can I capture this meaning and make it explode off the page in such a way that the person is deeply moved when they encounter it.
Yes. It almost seems out of character for you to write this book, since you are mostly a nonfiction writer, but of course, as you just stated, any art in life will benefit from the starting point of which you embellish in this book. And I'm wondering, what drew you into writing a how-to book like this?
Well, I have loved reading and books and writers from my earliest years. I mean, if a person goes to a library, even if they're in a town where they know no one, they'll find hundreds of friends. So you can, in a way, never be lonely if you're willing to go into that arena. And I've been touched by thousands of writers who became my close friends over the years through their work, and that drew me. But my particular form that I've loved to write in the most was nonfiction, and most of the nonfiction out there is really dreadful. It's just basically shopping lists. And even by accomplished novelists, you'll pick up a nonfiction novel they've written, and it's just dreadful. They just somehow lose all their talent. It just becomes a bunch of words in a row. You know, do this, now do this, now do that. But to me, that nonfictional dynamic, especially like how-to books or self-help books, there's so many of them. About 200,000 per year in the United States are being published.
I can vouch for that.
Right, but most of them are just, the information may be good, but the writing is poor. So it deserves to be an art form, and I've been working since my first book in 96 to turn my writing into some sort of an art form, so that when people read it, they're having this experience that's beyond just what the words on the page are. Because I love beautiful language. I love moments of duende where you get that goosebump experience from something you've read, and you go, gosh, that's incredible. And that's what I wanted to do in my own work. And after a while, was so irritated at the state of things, and also kind of the blandness of most writing. Most people are afraid to have a powerful opinion anymore about anything. And so I really wanted to address all of that. And finally, my irritation became so large, I wrote that book.
And it is a large book.
Yeah.
I hope you're not very irritated for the moment anyway.
No, I got that off my chest.
Oh,
I'm on to other irritating things.
All of that certainly relates to my favorite Mark Twain quote, I think, that you pulled in your book, Ensouling Language, that the difference between the
right word and almost the right word is the difference between lightning and a lightning bug.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'd love that. That was great.
I mean, that sums it up extremely well.
Yeah. So there you go. There's the three paragraphs into the sentence right there.
Yeah.
Talk about the imaginal realm, Stephen, and how you've learned to increase your time there. Is there a technique to being there and writing from there also?
There really is. And, most writers are incredibly superstitious when they don't really want to talk about what they do when they write, and especially now, because we live in such a reductionistic time where people are, extremely suspicious of things that aren't, you know, related to chemistry or physics or something. You know, the, you know, one critic, Jeffrey Hartman, called it the hermeneutics of suspicion is widespread, you know. Henry Corbin said it was the ingrained agnostic reflex, not meaning about religion, but any kind
of.
You know, I mean, if you even talk about love, a lot of writers get twitchy, you know. So the thing is, but when most writers talk about what they do, you know, all of the, you know, 99% of them, and certainly all the good ones, they say when they're writing, they go into a dream, and this dream flows through them onto the page, and then 6 or 8 or 10 hours later, they wake up, and then they look at it, and then they awaken from the dream and see this amazing thing that's happened. They literally go into a different state of mind. So that is rarely talked about in writing books, yet it's the core of the whole process. So I wanted to look at how can you go into that dream and let that dream flow onto the page through you. Okay, so that was part of it, but there's the second part of it. You know, the ancient Greeks, primarily the Athenians, they would talk about how the muses would come, that there was this otherworldly experience that literally happened when you went into the dream. Something flowed through you, whether you call it the mythic world or the mythic imagination or the imaginal realm, as some people have. You know, Henry Corbin, the great Islamic scholar, called it the mundus imaginalis, the imaginal world. And so you get into this place, and it's like the door opens up in you, and things flow through from some other place onto the page. And that's one of the reasons why when people read a great book and they're taken into this other world, these amazing things happen to their themselves, their personality, their consciousness, and they're so moved by it, and the characters become literally living beings that they'll talk about for the rest of their life, you know, as if they're next-door neighbors. And that thing comes out of what the ancient Athenians called the imaginal realm. The dream that you get in, when it goes deep enough, it accesses that stuff coming through from someplace else. And Homer talked about it. He said, this is a real territory. The muses really exist. And so I wanted to talk in detail about that, what that dynamic is like, how you can develop that and work with it basically as a reliable part of the writing craft. And so anyway, that's what I did.
Well, it was quite funny. You say most writers spend most of their time in the dreaming / analogical thinking state, not the full breakthrough through state long enough to write a book. But most of us don't like these people.
Stephen King is like a notorious example of this. The guy is incredibly talented. And so he can drop into that dreaming state at the drop of a hat. And most writers do, they learn how they go through all these processes, you know, whether they drink 50 cups of coffee and think of all the stuff that makes them mad.
Or a bottle of scotch.
that dynamic comes into play, too. And then they write and they get in that dreaming state. And, you know, that's almost all writers that are any good can do that after a while. They may not be able to control it well, but they know what it is, and they sort of know how to talk about it, and they can do it. But that imaginal state, where the full breakthrough state, every writer has moments where that occurs to them.
Right,
but I think very few writers spend, you know, and so for me, I'll hit that point and be in it. Let's say if I spend 6 months writing a book, full-time writing, I may be in that state maybe, you know, 4 weeks out of that entire period interspersed amongst those months. But there's some writers, and I suspect Stephen King may be one of them, who are so adept at the dreaming and have done it so long that they'll drop into that imaginal state and be there for incredibly long periods of time. And that's why I say, you know, yeah, there are a few people that can do it, but none of the rest of us like them very much.
Right, I know, but where I went with that immediately was, wait, isn't there a story to corroborate that about a guy on a cross?
Good point.
I have to mention here, I love the ancient Persian stories, beginning with at one time there was a story and there was no one to tell it.
There was no. Once upon a time there was a story, but there was no one to hear it.
Oh, to hear it, right? Yeah.
Right, and another one, and the other one I really like is when they say, "The Earth has six continents. We're going to the seventh now."
Oh, bravo!
As soon as you hear that, a human being cannot hear that if it's uttered in the proper way without a shift of state of mind, where there's the deep part of them that says, "Ah, we're about to start going into the imaginal realm now."
Yeah.
And that thing, there's little cues that writers that really know what they're doing, they always put those somewhere in the beginning of the story that they're telling. And that signals that deep part of the person that, yeah, we're going to this other place now. And then the conscious mind immediately starts to go into a slight dreaming state, and another part comes forward, the child part that says, yes, I want to hear that story, and I want to go to that place. You know, let me hear all these things, you know, and that it's a crucial, important part of storytelling.
Yes, really, yes. Well, I want to take advantage of your massive knowledge of the history of writing and writers and authors. And you mentioned in your book about Goethe saw archetypes as a word, not just characters or stories. And I'm wondering if you could maybe start this next conversation with what the definition is of an archetype. And have you noticed with all of your reading, has it changed?
It's mostly deepened. You know, I think everybody in the United States has a kind of a rough sense of archetype because the word is sort of entered common parlance. But, you know, like a lot of words like that, most people have a very slippery and loose sense of it. They know there's something it refers to. And that guy that you mentioned, Goethe, even, you know, I once spoke in Amsterdam, and I kept saying, and Goethe said this, and Goethe, and they were like, who, Goethe. And then finally they go, I explained it, and they go, oh, Goethe, or something. It's like, you know, it's impossible for Americans, you know, to pronounce that name. But anyway, he was like this great German poet, mostly known for Faust, and then most people don't know he was a great botanist and natural philosopher as well. But, you know, his concept of, because of a lot of my work with plants, and I've been aware of his work, you know, he would say, talk about that all plant forms, underneath all plant forms is the archetype of a plant. And then when it comes into the world, and it changes based on wherever it grows. And that's pretty much standard scientific theory now. So the interesting thing is that he also talked about writing in very much that way, that, you know, that stories come from that other world, the imagined world, like the Greeks would call it, Plato called it the realm of the forms with a capital F, and other Greeks might have called it the realm of the archai. And this was a non-material place where, you know, the original thing itself existed, and then when it went into, let's say, the imaginal world, it became the archetype, or its first expression in this world, you might say, is the archetype. It's an archai, it just means the original thing, and then type means an impress or a form. So then you get the first form of it, and then every expression of it, it begins to mutate depending upon where it grows. So the stories that we tell, there's thousands upon thousands of stories, but all of them relate back to some, you know, people look at originals like themes or whatever in stories, and we're all just telling, in a way, the same story over and over and over again, in a sense. But it shifts because it's taking root in our particular field, and that shifts the way it appears, the way it's told. And Henry David Thoreau was great. He said, you know, if you tell the story true, then I will have to be fascinated by it because you come from a different country than I will ever know. And the only way I will ever hear it is if you give me your truthful, accurate reports of it. And so even though we've read a story 100 times of boy meets girl, boy falls in love with girl, boy loses girl, boy does all this stuff to get girl back. I mean, we've read that story 1,000 times, but nevertheless, if it's told true by a new writer, every time it's going to teach us something new about being a human being, about living in this world. And that's part of the thing that we're seeking is that kind of knowledge that goes at a very deep level. It satisfies something crucial and essential in the human being to have it.
Yes, somewhere there was writing in your book speaking about, I don't know if it was a quote you gleaned from somewhere or if it was your own actual writing about, and it doesn't matter, of course, but about the archetype of a plant manifesting in the world, and it is inherently dynamical and indefinitely flexible.
Right, and that's one of the amazing things about, you know, and I love plants as, you know, one of humans' great teachers, but yes, they're inherently dynamical and flexible, and no matter what environment they're in, there's this interaction that goes between the environment and the plant begins to shift and obtain new forms and generate new forms and behavior in really a single generation quite often. So that idea of that inherent mutability and flexibility that's also extremely responsive to environmental cues is, I think, a brilliant thing. And that's part of what's crucial to me about storytelling is that, the language that we use, we're trying to capture something that mutable, that flexible, that alive in a static form. We're trying to capture life itself and the meanings that flow through life and these deep archetypes and story forms. And so our language has to be extremely mutable and flexible to do that, which is one of the reasons I hate grammar Nazis, because to them, language is a static, dead thing, you see.
So, yes, of course. Do you think certain languages hold open a bigger door into the dreaming state than others?
You know, that I since I don't speak a whole lot of languages, that's hard for me to say. I just know it theoretically. A lot of people have said English is particularly suited for storytelling and writing because it's one of the most flexible and mutable of languages, and then it pulls into it all other languages and then for its own, you know, purposes. I mean, we have a lot of words from French and German and even Serbian. I just found out the other day the word vampire is Serbian. It's the only Serbian word that's gone around the world, you know. So that thing, apparently, according to a lot of scholars, English is. But then again, other languages have words for experiences that we don't have a way to express in our language. So I think every language, people are trying to capture some invisible way of the human relationship to the reality in which they're embedded. And so even every time we lose a language, it's a bad thing.
Sure, it's like losing a species of plant or animal.
We've lose an observation about the nature of reality that can never be reclaimed. And,
right, but, you know, there's all the new that keeps coming as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, that's a whole other topic of discussion. We don't have time to go there today. You speak about the form we see in this world as a modified expression of the archetype that underlies it, and some could argue that this is where fiction begins, because if you're talking from a purely spiritual standpoint, what you can see, taste, smell, or touch is an illusion.
And it's not, you know, and I have to differ a little bit on that. It's not really an illusion. It's that's only one layer of its reality. So, I mean, I talk in detail about how reductionists have been damaging the language for a long time by, you know, imposing a mechanicalist frame on everything that we encounter. Like when we see a chair, you know, so people say, well, that's a thing, you can touch it and it's this and that. But the height, depth, and breadth, the physicality of a chair is really only its most superficial attributes, you know, and I go into detail about that, how a chair also has meaning to it. When we do the condensation of meaning that we call identifying a chair, it happens so automatically that we think, you know, it's just reality. But babies don't do that because they don't have attributions of meaning already in place. They're experiencing the meaning of a thing directly without the intermediary of language. And it's that kind of thing, moving away from you know, the apparent mechanicalism of description into an experience of the meaning of things. Because when a writer writes about a chair, they're also writing about the feeling tone of the chair, which is a key to its deeper meanings. And that those meanings, every chair has a little bit different feeling to it, and everybody knows that. But when you're putting a chair or a desk or a house into a story, it has attributes, feeling attributes, emotional attributes, that and meaning attributes that are very deep and very important. And they weave into the story just like a character does, and they shift the dynamics of the story considerably. So with a fiction writer, you know, they're taking all of these things that they've encountered in their life and putting it together in almost a dreaming kind of way, like a dream you would have at night. And a nonfiction writer is taking some apparently stuff that's already there, like if they're doing a biography of somebody's life and they're going through the motions from A to B to C. But at the same time, a really good nonfiction writer, they're understanding that they're working with meanings in just the same way. It's just they're adapting how they're doing it to the particular form of writing that they're doing. So I think it's more, I think it's important to count the reality of the material world because it's a crucial part of life experience. But at the same time, to not think that that's all there is to something. I mean, the mechanicalists have really stolen the luminous nature of the world from a lot of us, and part of my work is to try to get it back.
Well, exactly. That would certainly define the job of any good writer. And
I think you're exactly right about that.
And what about the nonfiction writers? I mean, there's you brought up a biographer. Now, there's so much space in telling a story about someone's life to have that creative essence. And then you have the writer who writes the nuts and bolts about plumbing or building.
Right, and
or
I talk about
like that
a lot. But, you know, a writer that's writing a book on plumbing that's good at it, you're going to go into that same kind of luminous experience. And I give some in-depth examples about from a book written by a furniture maker who's a truly remarkable guy, and his books are very luminous that way. I give some examples from Raoul Hilberg, who is a Holocaust historian, whose books have that luminous nature. Or, you know, that getting that luminous nature in there, having the work come alive, is the duty of a writer who's taking on this art as their craft. And, you know, language has been so dumbed down in a certain sense and so become so reductive that, you know, many people just think they can, as William Gass put it, he says, you know, most people write the way kids throw snow at a wall. And that pretty much sums up most of nonfiction. But it really needs to go beyond that, and there's no reason why it shouldn't.
I hope you'll join us next week when we conclude with Stephen Buhner, author of Ensouling Language, The Art of Nonfiction and the Writer's Life. For any guest information, to listen to archives and share resources, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.